The Inconceivable Emancipation. Themes from the Vimalakirti Nidesha by Sangharakshita. Read by Subhadra. Chapter 1. The Magic of a Mahayana Sutra. Nearly all of us share a particular perception of our own lives, which we know to be essentially false. This perception is that our lives tend to be characterized by a certain sameness. We spend our time doing much the same sort of things, day after day, even year after year. However much we try to introduce variety, interest, and excitement into our lives, we settle into routines. Patterns of one kind or another develop. At the very least, we all have to perform all sorts of ordinary human functions, getting dressed, eating, defecating, sleeping, day after day. And we have a sense that our experience of things, of the things we do every day or every week, is just the same every time. Of course, we know that this is not really the case. We may be washing up the same dishes every day, but we don't wash them in exactly the same circumstances. Each time we wash the dishes is a unique, unrepeatable occasion. Every time we meet a friend, even if we see them every day, it is really for the first time. Every moment of our lives is unique. Unfortunately, it is all too easy to forget this. We tend to feel that we are doing the same old things in the same old way, day in, day out. Routine and habit seem to drive all the freshness and spontaneity out of life. This can happen not just in our everyday ordinary lives, but in our spiritual lives as well. Spiritual life is all about change, development, growth. We know that every time we meditate, for instance, is a completely new experience. We know that it is not even just a question of every time. There is only ever just one time. Each experience, by its very nature, is unrepeatable. This perception of the uniqueness of our experience is what in the Buddhist tradition is known as beginner's mind. But if we are honest, we have to admit that we don't always experience this beginner's mind, that our spiritual practice can feel just as flat, dull, and stale as everything else. If we are beset by this kind of spiritual ennui, it is vital that we shake it off, that we get completely away from any feeling that life, even spiritual life, is dull and boring. From time to time, we need to let go of what seems ordinary, safe, comprehensible, and allow ourselves to experience, at least in imagination, some other universe, some other dimension of being, some other system of things. The answer, we may find, is to enter, from time to time, the mysterious world of the Mahayana Sutras. We can, if we choose, take a plunge into the unfamiliar, extraordinary, even bizarre world of a work like the Vimalakirti Nidesha, a world where all the familiar landmarks are removed, a world where we may feel that we are being turned completely upside down. The Vimalakirti Nidesha contains pieces of straightforward doctrinal exposition which touch upon some of the most profound philosophical themes of Buddhism. It also contains passages of lavish description, including descriptions of all sorts of magical feats and happenings. It contains poetry, even poetry in the formal sense of the term. It contains elements of biography and autobiography, and reminiscence, and even episodes of high drama, together with quite a bit of humour. Altogether, it is an exuberant and complex work, surprisingly so when one considers how short it is. It consists of only 14 quite brief chapters. The English translation is just about 100 pages. It is no longer than a long, short story, yet it brings together quite a number of very important themes. Before we take our first step into this rich and strange world, a few words of explanation about the origin of the text are probably in order. It is, to begin with, a Mahayana text. The Sanskrit word Mahayana means simply the great way. So the Mahayana is that form of Buddhism which sets no limit whatever upon the spiritual potential of the individual. It encourages all living beings without exception to aim at the highest conceivable, even the highest inconceivable, goal of the spiritual life, supreme perfect enlightenment. One who aims at this supreme perfect enlightenment, not only for their own sake, but for the benefit of all beings, is known as a bodhisattva. A being, sattva, dedicated to awakening, bodhi. To put it very simply, you could say that for the Mahayana, the bodhisattva is the ideal Buddhist. It's what every Buddhist would like to become. And you become a bodhisattva by developing in yourself those qualities which will give rise to what is called the bodhicitta, the urge or will to enlightenment. The path of the bodhisattva begins when you take the four great vows. 1. However innumerable beings are, I vow to deliver them. 2. However inexhaustible the passions are, I vow to extinguish them. 3. However immeasurable the teachings are, I vow to master them. 4. However incomparable the Buddha truth is, I vow to attain it. These magnificent, awe-inspiring vows may seem like a tall order, to say the least. What we have to understand here is that there is not really any question of our ordinary limited self taking these vows, as though it were making them part of itself. It is more that, in taking the vows, the ordinary self opens itself up to the forces of wisdom and compassion which they represent, allowing itself to be inspired and transformed by them, allowing wisdom and compassion to work through it. So these four great vows express the essential spirit of the tradition out of which this sutra emerged. The word sutra means simply thread, especially in the sense of a connecting thread. In the Buddhist context, sutras are a particular type or class of Buddhist canonical text, so called because they usually deal with a number of different topics in a more or less connected fashion. So prominent is this class of text within the Buddhist canon that the sutras have become almost synonymous with what in the West we tend to call the Buddhist scriptures. However, it is a little misleading to think of these texts as scriptures. The word scripture literally means something written down, but the sutras were not originally preserved in written form. The Buddha himself, as far as we know, never wrote anything at all. As he travelled around northeastern India, meeting people and teaching them, he communicated entirely by means of the spoken word. He communicated the Dharma orally, face to face, directly, as much of it as his listeners could assimilate, as much of it as they could bear. And those who came into contact with him remembered what he had said. Sometimes it made a tremendous impression upon them. Sometimes it brought about a turning point in their lives. So how could they forget it? It was burned into their hearts, into their minds, into their very being. And as they put the teachings into practice, they absorbed them, became one with them, learnt them by heart. In time, the Buddha's followers attracted their own disciples and taught them in the same way, by word of mouth. Their disciples in turn carried on the oral tradition, and in this way the Buddha's teaching was handed down orally in India for several centuries, until it was eventually committed to writing, not all at once, but bit by bit, over several hundred years. It is this oral tradition, in written form, which constitutes Buddhist canonical literature. Some sutras are still extant in the original Pali or Sanskrit languages in which they are first written down, but others are known to us only through ancient Chinese and Tibetan translations. Broadly speaking, then, a Mahayana Sutra is a canonical text in which the Buddha is represented as teaching, directly or indirectly, the Bodhisattva ideal, the ideal of supreme perfect enlightenment for the benefit of all living beings. There are hundreds, perhaps thousands, of Mahayana Sutras in existence. The Perfection of Wisdom Sutras, which include the well-known Diamond Sutra and Heart Sutra, the White Lotus Sutra, the Sutra of Golden Light, and many others. The Vimalakirti Nirdesha, although a Mahayana text, cannot really be counted among these sutras, inasmuch as it is not quite a sutra in the usual sense. In Sanskrit, it is not actually called a sutra at all, and in the Chinese translations, it is called a ching. Ching is the usual translation of sutra in Chinese, but the term originally meant classic in the literary sense. The Sanskrit title of the work is simply Vimalakirti Nirdesha, which means the teaching or exposition or instruction of Vimalakirti. Vimalakirti's name means something like stainless glory, immaculate fame, or pure repute. And he is represented as a Buddhist layman living in the northern Indian city of Vaishali at the time of the Buddha. The point is that it is Vimalakirti who does most of the teaching in this work, not the Buddha, that is, Shakyamuni Buddha himself. If a sutra is defined as a discourse by the Buddha, there are clear grounds for not giving this title to the Vimalakirti Nirdesha. However, Shakyamuni does appear in the text at several points, especially the beginning and the end. He does teach, and he does, as it were, adopt the work at the end. Perhaps, therefore, there is another reason for dispensing with the term sutra. Perhaps it is that sutra, like scripture, suggests something spiritually authoritative. In fact, of course, it does no such thing. Spiritually authoritative is really a contradiction in terms. The Buddhist scriptures, as we call them in English, do not, like the Bible, constitute infallible revelation from God. They are a record of the life and teaching of a supremely and perfectly enlightened human being, a human being who was the living embodiment of absolute wisdom and infinite compassion. Nonetheless, some people do probably read a sutra as though it were holy writ, and feel that they have no choice but to accept whatever the Buddha says in it, whether they like it or not. And such a projection of authority, it may create in them some resistance to the sutra's message. But if a particular text is not actually labelled a sutra, we can avoid the mistake of regarding it as spiritually authoritative. We can read it, in fact, more or less as we would read any other work of the imagination, a novel, a poem, or a short story. If we can read Buddhist texts as literature rather than dogma, as poetry rather than scientific fact or philosophical truth, we may perhaps be more open to their spiritual message. We may even allow ourselves to be captivated, at least a little, by their atmosphere and magic. Conversely, and this is just a thought, we might try reading works of imagination as though they were sutras, and in this way open ourselves to their real spiritual content. What I'm getting at is that sutras can be approached as sources of inspiration and enjoyment, not as texts that you have to slog your way through because you happen to be a Buddhist. You may have to put in some additional study and reflection. It may take some time and many readings to understand a sutra deeply and really appreciate it. But some phrases or images may affect you quite powerfully straight away. It is true that we may well feel more at home with Western literature. Most of it is easier to read because it has been written by unenlightened people like ourselves, with all sorts of little glimmers of insight here and there. And it deals generally with ordinary human predicaments with which we can easily identify. But human frailty is not the only possible subject for literature. It is certainly not always the most inspiring and uplifting one. We can also read literature which takes us away from our ordinary human life and its frailties. And this is what the Mahayana Sutra is all about, to take us away from the ordinary, to give us a taste of the magical. Obviously, it is difficult to rise to that level of experience, so it's going to be difficult to read sutras, just as it is to read some of the great works of Western literature. Any work of literature has an effect commensurate with the effort one makes to understand it. It is really a matter of getting into the habit of stretching oneself a bit. If you have a strong enough desire to understand, you will make the effort. This is why translations like Robert A. F. Thurman's version of the Vimalakirti Nidesha are so valuable. If the language is beautiful, you can read and enjoy a text, even though you don't fully understand it. It is as though the beauty of the language has its own value. One can read and enjoy the authorized version of the Bible, for instance, without believing a word of it. The authorized version was gradually shaped out of several earlier translations. No doubt more attractive versions of the Mahayana Sutras will emerge in a similar way. We know that the Vimalakirti Nidesha is one of the older Mahayana Sutras, but we do not know when it was first written down, because the Indian scribes did not date their work. They were not historically and chronologically minded. With the Chinese, however, it was another matter. When they translated Buddhist texts from Sanskrit into Chinese, they recorded not only the name of the translator, together with that of whoever assisted him and the place where he was working, but also the day of the week and the month and the year when he started, and the precise date when he finished as well. The Vimalakirti Nidesha must have been a very popular text in China, because in the course of the centuries, some 7 Chinese translations were made, among them versions by Kumarajiva and Zhuang Tsang, the 2 greatest translators of Buddhist texts to appear in the entire practically 2,000-year history of Chinese Buddhism. Kumarajiva's version is remarkable, as are all his versions of Buddhist texts, especially of Mahayana Sutras, for its fidelity to the spirit of the original and its great literary beauty. Zhuang Tsang's version, on the other hand, is impressive in its scholarly accuracy and precision. Kumarajiva's version has always been by far the more popular of the two. One complete Tibetan translation is also extant, as well as fragments of translations in various Central Asian languages. Fascinating, readable, and inspiring of all Mahayana sutras. The 3 English versions current are by Charles Luc, Etienne Lamotte, his French translation having been rendered into English by Sarah Boyne, and Robert Thurman. Luc's version, based on Kumarajiva, is perhaps the most traditional of the 3, in the strict sense of the term traditional. Lamotte's, based on the Tibetan version and on Zhuang Tsang, is the most scholarly in the academic sense. Thurman's version, the most recent, is based mainly on Tibetan, comes somewhere in between, and I would say above, these 2. It is both traditional and scholarly in the best sense of these terms, but at the same time, scholarship has been subordinated to the needs for spiritual understanding. Thurman has also taken great pains with the literary style. The result is almost a model version of an English translation of a Mahayana Sutra. Traditional, scholarly, and also very readable. A rare combination of qualities, as you will know only too well if you have ploughed your way through more indigestible English translations of Buddhist texts. Reading Thurman's version of the Vimalakirti Nidesha is not only a spiritual experience, but also a literary one. It is this translation, for the most part, that I will be using as my source text. The Vimalakirti Nidesha has several alternative titles, the most important of which is Achintya Vimoksha, the inconceivable emancipation. It is in terms of emancipation that the goal of the spiritual life has been envisaged in Buddhism from the most ancient times down to the present day. emancipation from craving, from hatred, from delusion, from all that conditions and confines us, from all that distorts our deepest creativity, from all that prevents us from becoming enlightened. This experience of spiritual emancipation, of absolute liberation, of total freedom, is what the Buddha's teaching is all about, and what essentially it has always been all about. Vimoksha is one of a whole group of similar terms, very prominent in early Buddhism. In addition to Vimoksha and Moksha, Pali Vimokka and Mokka, there are also Vimukti and Mukti, in Pali Vimutti and Mutti. The prefix V acts as an emphatic in Pali and Sanskrit. They all have the same general sense of emancipation, liberation or freedom, and they are words which occur over and over again in Pali and Sanskrit texts. In a well-known passage in the Udana, the verses of uplift, the Buddha says that just as wherever you take the water from, the mighty ocean has but one taste, the taste of salt, in the same way his teaching, whether you take the Four Noble Truths, the Noble Eightfold Path, the Six Paramitas, conditioned co-production, Shunyata, or whatever, has but one taste, the taste of freedom. According to another well-known formula, there are four stages of spiritual development: morality or uprightness, concentration and meditation, or higher consciousness, transcendental wisdom or insight into reality, and emancipation. Here again the term used is Vimutti. Vimutti is also the penultimate stage of the spiral path, the spiritual path described in terms of the 12 positive links. Here, freedom arises in dependence upon dispassion, a state of complete spiritual serenity or imperturbability. Dispassion, in turn, arises in dependence upon disentanglement from worldly concerns, which is itself consequent upon the attainment of knowledge and vision of things as they really are. In terms of the spiral path, therefore, freedom is again consequent upon insight. Sometimes freedom is spoken of as being twofold. Chetto Vimukti is the emancipation of the heart, complete freedom from all subjective, emotional and psychological biases. Prajna Vimukti is the emancipation that comes from wisdom, freedom from all wrong views, all ignorance, all opinions. This twin freedom of heart and mind is the summit of human experience. Then there is the teaching of the eight Vimokshas, the eight emancipations or releases. These represent successively more refined levels of meditative experience, a movement from the realm of the senses, the Kamaloka, to the Rupaloka, the realm of form, or the archetypal realm, and eventually the Arupaloka, the formless realm. The eighth of these releases corresponds to enlightenment itself. Yet another way of describing emancipation is in terms of the three Vimokshamukhas, or doors to emancipation, also known as the three Samadhis. These are three different approaches to the realization of the unconditioned. According to Buddhist tradition, conditioned, mundane existence has three primary characteristics. That is, it is unsatisfactory, impermanent, and insubstantial. Having developed the profound wisdom which penetrates one of these three characteristics, so that you really see the unsatisfactoriness, impermanence, and insubstantiality of things, you attain the corresponding emancipation, which gives you a way in, a doorway, to the unconditioned. These are just some of the ways in which the Buddhist tradition has expressed the dimension of spiritual experience, which it calls Vimoksha. But achincha means inconceivable or unthinkable. It also suggests inexpressible, even ungraspable. The achincha vimoksha, or inconceivable emancipation, is an emancipation which is particular to the Buddhas and irreversible Bodhisattvas, and that is really all we can say about it. Because it is inconceivable, it is also inexpressible. We can go further than that. We can say that all emancipations, to the extent that they are emancipations, are inconceivable. Indeed, emancipation is always emancipation from something. The term has no meaning except in relation to a previous state of bondage or imprisonment. And when we have always been in a particular state, we cannot really imagine what emancipation from it is like. Indeed, when we have always been in a state of imprisonment, we cannot really get any sense of how imprisoned we are. We may even think that we are not imprisoned at all. We realize the extent to which we were imprisoned only when we have attained release from that imprisonment. If we cannot understand how imprisoned we are by this and by that, we have little chance of being able to imagine what the state of emancipation from that imprisonment would be like. It is simply inconceivable to us. We often speak of higher spiritual experience, or even nirvana, as if we knew all about it, but we don't. In fact, we don't really know anything about it at all. We cannot even conceive of it, and it is important to remember this. It means that, as we progress in the spiritual life, we are going forward into the unknown. Commitment to the spiritual life is commitment to the unknown. Emancipation, spiritual emancipation, is always emancipation from the known, and the attainment of emancipation is always attainment of the unknown, the unpredictable, the unforeseen, even the unforeseeable. Every emancipation is therefore inconceivable. But the inconceivable emancipation of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas is inconceivable, according to the Mahayana, in a special and deeper sense. The Mahayana, like the Hinayana, sees existence not statically, but dynamically, not in terms of entities, but in terms of processes, not in terms of fixed, solid, unchanging things, but in terms of what are called dharmas, an untranslatable term, which means something like phenomena. According to the Mahayana, and this is where it differs from the Hinayana, these dharmas are in the ultimate sense neither existent nor non-existent. Existent and non-existent are only ideas of our own mind. Because they are neither existent nor non-existent, they naturally neither appear nor disappear. Suffering, for instance, doesn't really appear, and it doesn't really disappear. Dharmas are thus peaceful from the beginning, and by nature completely, to coin a rather ungainly word, nirvanized. We are accustomed to thinking of nirvana, enlightenment, as a noun, as representing a state rather than a process. But it does appear in a verbal form in both Pali and Sanskrit. Obviously, a verb describes action, and action takes place in time, but nirvanization is not a process taking place in time. It represents the fact that all dharmas are in a state of not being affected in reality by either arising or ceasing. But this does not mean that enlightenment is something static. In short, we really have no words for this state of affairs. Moreover, because dharmas are neither existent nor non-existent, they have no separate characteristics by which they can be distinguished or recognized. Because they have no separate characteristics, they are inconceivable and inexpressible. All dharmas are therefore the same, or rather, to avoid giving any impression that Buddhism teaches some sort of monism, not different. Buddhism does not teach that all the phenomena of existence are reducible to one, whether to one absolute being, like the Brahman of the Vedantic tradition, or the substance of Spinoza, or to one matter. Buddhism therefore speaks in terms of not different, or not two, the Sanskrit is advaya, rather than the same, or one. We need to avoid any suggestion that the concept of sameness is being reified, Indeed, for the Mahayana, there can be no question of the rarefication of any of these terms. Yes, all dharmas are void of self-nature, as it is expressed, but this voidness is not itself an entity. Voidness is also void. It is not, I need hardly say, easy to understand this. The inconceivable emancipation really is inconceivable. Not only that, the Bodhisattva sees that existence itself is inconceivable. It is not just that we don't know anything about higher spiritual experience or nirvana. We don't really know anything about anything at all. It's not that we don't know very much, or that we don't know it very well. This statement is to be taken quite literally. We don't know anything about anything. But of course, we think we know, and on that basis we build up all sorts of thought constructions, all sorts of ideas, attitudes, views, and philosophies. But according to the Mahayana, these are nothing but delusions. We don't really know anything about anything. And this is something to reflect on from time to time. We are usually so sure that we know what's what. But just take a stone in your hand and feel it. Just look at a flower or a tree, and you will see that they are inconceivable. A human being, too, is inconceivable, staggeringly inconceivable. And of course a Buddha, an enlightened human being, is utterly inconceivable. A Bodhisattva is inconceivable. Buddhism is inconceivable. So here we have a paradox. The Dharma reveals the nature of existence, but if the nature of existence is inconceivable and not to be fathomed by thought, it cannot be uttered in words. Not only can we not know anything about anything, we cannot really say anything about anything. If the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas see existence as inconceivable and the Dharma as inexpressible, how is it possible for them to say anything about it? How is the Dharma to be taught? With this question, we begin to get quite close to the strange world of the Vimalakirti Nidesha. Even the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas cannot really teach the Dharma in words. Instead, they demonstrate it through action, and in particular through magical action. According to Buddhist tradition, the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas possess all sorts of magical powers. They can move things from place to place, create things, transform themselves into the likeness of anything they wish. Moreover, they can do all this on a cosmic scale. They can move whole universes and play with space and time. In Chapter 5 of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, for example, Vimalakirti prepares for the visit of Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, and a great crowd of various beings, by magically causing the contents of his house to vanish. When the visitors arrive, nothing is to be seen except Vimalakirti lying on his bed, apparently ill. In the next chapter, he has 3,200,000 thrones transported from a distant Buddha land, so that everyone can sit down, and his house enlarges itself to accommodate them all. In Chapter 10, Vimalakirti miraculously enables the company to see yet another of the many faraway Buddha lands. All Buddha lands have their own particular characteristics. In this one, everything is composed of fragrances, including the food, some of which is brought back by a messenger magically emanated by Vimalakirti for the purpose. A single vessel of this food proves sufficient to feed everyone present, including the 90 million Bodhisattvas who have accompanied it from whence it came. There is even some left over. There are many more such happenings throughout the Vimalakirti Nidesha. But why on earth does Vimalakirti do this sort of thing? Why should he make his immediate surroundings invisible and far distant Buddha lands visible? Why should he go to the trouble of shifting lion thrones and magical foodstuffs around? Why bother? all this materializing begins to sound like the stuff of transcendental science fiction. The simple answer is that in the world of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, such magical acts are regarded as being demonstrations of the Dharma. After each magical occurrence, the text tells us that many thousands, or even hundreds of thousands, of beings attain some higher state of spiritual insight, usually the spirit of unexcelled perfect enlightenment, that is, the bodhicitta. Their spiritual vision has been broadened and deepened by these magical acts. In chapter 6, Vimalakirti explicitly states that the ability to perform such acts is an aspect of the inconceivable emancipation. The bodhisattvas who live in this emancipation, he says, thoroughly realize the relativity of space and time. They can put Mount Sumeru into a mustard seed without shrinking the one or enlarging the other. They can place all living beings in the palm of their hand. They can make a week seem like an age, and an age like a week. They have the magical power to transform anyone into anyone, and anything into anything. The Vimalakirti Nidesha is not alone among Mahayana texts in its attribution of a philosophical significance to magic. In the Mahayana, existence itself is frequently compared to a magic show. But how does this square with the Buddha's well-known admonition to his disciples that they should positively refrain from performing miracles? How can magical acts be regarded as demonstrations of the Dharma? Magic was very popular in India in ancient times, as I believe it still is today. It seems that the Indians have always been rather good at it. Imagine, for example, a wandering magician walking into a village in ancient India one morning. Perhaps he has left his magic carpet round the corner. As he arrives, a drum starts to beat, and people begin to gather round, eager and expectant, waiting for something to happen. It's natural to be curious about such things. If a magician came down the street at this very minute, you would probably drop the book and go out and have a look, and rightly so, because you can read a book any old time, but you don't see a magical display every day of the week. In the ancient Indian village, the magician would no doubt start off by doing something quite routine, quite ordinary, the kind of thing that magicians are expected to do. He conjures up, let's say, an elephant. He repeats a certain mantra, and instantly, in front of everybody, an elephant appears. There it calmly stands, as large as life, bulky body, flapping ears, waving trunk. People can see it, hear it, perhaps smell it, perhaps even touch it, or think that they can touch it. Maybe some people in the audience even get frightened and run away. In the modern West, we would probably call this a collective hallucination. But the Mahayana would point out that the elephant perceived by all those villagers is neither absolutely unreal nor absolutely non-existent. After all, you cannot easily deny the testimony of your own eyes. Everybody in the village knows perfectly well what an elephant looks like, and they have all seen one standing in front of them. Furthermore, it has had an effect, because some people have run away. But at the same time, it is not absolutely real, not absolutely existent. The magician made it appear, and sooner or later he will make it disappear. According to the Mahayana, ordinary existence, as we experience it, is just like this. The Dharmas are just like this. They are neither existent nor non-existent, not in absolute terms, so they cannot be said really to appear or really to disappear. They are just like the magical illusion. Existence is just like a great collective hallucination. The Mahayana also compares it to a dream, an echo, a mirage, a reflection, a ball of foam, and so on. The point of all these comparisons is not that something which is not really there is perceived to exist, but rather that what is perceived to exist is not absolutely existent. Phenomenal existence arises in dependence on causes and conditions, so it is neither absolutely real nor absolutely unreal. absolutely real here means that which does not arise in dependence on causes and conditions. In terms of the older Buddhist texts, it is what is usually translated as the unconditioned, the asamskrita, literally the incomposite, that which is not put together. But even if everything is, in a sense, like a magical illusion, we still have to engage with it because we consider it to be real. When the magician conjures up the elephant, people perceive it and even become frightened enough to run away. Their fright is a real experience, at least relatively real, and something has to be done about it. So the fact that your relative experience is, in a sense, illusory doesn't mean that you ignore it. You experience it as real, just as the people who perceive the illusory elephant perceive it as real. They don't know that it is illusory. They don't know that their perception has arisen in dependence on the complex of causes and conditions represented by the magician. Only when they see that there is no elephant there, absolutely existent in its own right, but only a phenomenon that has arisen in dependence on the volition of the magician, can they cease to act as though the elephant were real. Continuing the traditional Buddhist line of thought, if you were enlightened, you would perceive the elephant, but you would know that what you were perceiving was a magical illusion, so you would not react to it as you would if you were not enlightened. Even if it charged towards you, you would know that nothing was going to happen, that it was only an illusion, so you would not try to get out of the way or experience any fear. But to take this illustration a little further, if you were enlightened and you saw a real elephant charging towards you, you would get out of the way, because you would know that your physical body was on the same level of existence as the elephant's. Even though both are illusory in the metaphysical sense, both are physical bodies. They exist within and belong to the same order of reality, and within that order of reality, they can affect one another. But you would still not experience fear, because your mind would be attuned not to relative reality, but to absolute reality. In a sense, whether you are enlightened or not, you see the same object, but you interpret it differently. For instance, things are impermanent, and it is obviously inappropriate to be attached to things which are impermanent. Nonetheless, we do become attached, despite the fact that we know that something is impermanent. We treat it as though it is permanent. And if you see or experience an illusion as an absolute reality and treat it accordingly, that gives rise to unskillful mental states. But if you were enlightened, you would be fully aware of its impermanence and would treat it as such. Using the terms illusion or illusory when discussing Buddhism can create a lot of misunderstanding. The illustration of the magically produced elephant is an illusion only when it is considered metaphysically, not in terms of ordinary human experience. There is an objective difference between an elephant which is actually an elephant and an elephant which is only an illusory elephant. This is where Mahayana Buddhism differs from the Hinduism of the Advaita Vedanta. Vedantins would use the same illustration to try to show that the elephant conjured up by the magician doesn't exist in reality at all. For Advaita Vedanta, the whole of phenomenal existence is like that. Only ultimate reality exists. Some Vedantins might regard this as an unfair presentation of Shankara's teaching, but many Indian philosophers, including Sri Aurobindo, have taken it to be his actual view, a view which Buddhism would regard as being one-sided. We can see the difference in the positions of the two religions if we consider their usage of the term maya, illusion. In the Advaita Vedanta, maya indicates that which doesn't have any existence at all, but is pure illusion. But in Buddhism, it indicates that which has a relative, but not an absolute existence. And of course, Buddhism goes further and says that, in the last analysis, there is no distinction between the relative and the absolute. It is not that the relative is merged into the absolute in a one-sided manner, as in the Advaita Vedanta. Both the terms relative and the term absolute are equally applicable and equally inapplicable to ultimate reality. So the Mahayana does not doubt or question our experience. It is not trying to tell us that nothing exists at all. What it questions is the ultimate validity of the conceptual constructions which we superimpose upon it. Where we go wrong is in interpreting our experience in terms of fixed, solid, unchanging things. This is why the Vimalakirti Nidesha and the Mahayana in general regard magical acts as being demonstrations of the Dharma, because these acts are themselves an illustration of what existence is really like. It is this magical atmosphere in which the events of the Vimalakirti Nidesha unfold. One could spend a lifetime exploring the text and contemplating the vision it presents, but here we will be looking at just a few of its themes. To get an idea of the context in which these themes appear, however, we will begin with a brief survey of the whole work. Although we have seen the text is not, strictly speaking, a sutra, it opens in typical Mahayana sutra fashion, with the Buddha surrounded by a great assembly of disciples giving a teaching. On this occasion, he is staying at Amrapali's Park on the outskirts of the city of Vaishali, Vaishali being where the historical Buddha gave a great many of his teachings. And the great assembly surrounding him is made up of all sorts of beings, arhants, bodhisattvas, as well as brahmas and various non-human beings, gods and deities of all kinds, besides monks and nuns, laymen and laywomen. Just as the Buddha is about to start teaching, the bodhisattva Ratnakara arrives from Vaishali to visit him, accompanied by no fewer than 500 Lichavi youths, that is, young men of the tribe whose capital was Vaishali, and each of these youths carries with him an umbrella or parasol. These are not to shield them from sun or rain. In ancient India, parasols were not just utilitarian, but symbolized sovereignty, or even spiritual sovereignty. And like so many things in Mahayana sutras, these parasols were made of the seven precious substances, gold, pearl, and so on. The Lichavi youths offer these 500 parasols to the Buddha, and with his magical power, he transforms them all into a single enormous precious canopy, which covers the entire billion-world galaxy. In this precious canopy, every single world and every single being within the galaxy is reflected. After praising the Buddha in a very beautiful hymn, Ratnakara asks him to explain how a bodhisattva creates and purifies a Buddha land. We will be going into the Buddha's reply in our chapter 2, Building the Buddha Land. In the second chapter of the text, the scene shifts to the city of Vaishali, and we meet Vimalakirti himself. He is a great bodhisattva, even a Buddha, but he lives just like an ordinary layman. He lives at home, seems to have a family, seems to have a job, seems to be like other people. But all this is simply his skillful means. He outwardly adapts himself to people so that he can approach them and teach them the Dharma. And as part of his skillful means, he falls sick, or appears to fall sick. As a result, all sorts of people come to visit him, and he takes the opportunity of teaching them the Dharma. This will be the subject of our chapter 3, on being all things to all men. In chapters 3 and 4 of the text, we move back to Amrapali's park, where the Buddha airs the suggestion that someone should call on Vimalakirti and ask him how he is. He asks first the Arhats, beginning with Sariputra, and then the Bodhisattvas, beginning with Maitreya. But they are all strangely reluctant to meet Vimalakirti. They have, it seems, encountered him before, and, Arhats or Bodhisattvas though they are, he has treated them all to a very rough time. That is to say, he has ruthlessly exposed the inadequacies of their approach to the Dharma. We will be going into this in our chapter 4, The Transcendental Critique of Religion. In the next chapter of the Vimalakirti Nidesha, someone finally agrees to visit Vimalakirti. Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of Wisdom, says he will go. And together with many of those in the assembly, he sets out for Vaishali. When he arrives at Vimalakirti's house, he immediately enters into a vigorous dialogue with Vimalakirti on the nature of emptiness and liberation. Each tries to give the other a real dialectical hammering, but they are very evenly matched. Once this little transcendental sparring match is over, Manjushri comes to the point and asks Vimalakirti why he is sick. Vimalakirti's reply to this question has become very famous. He says that he is sick because beings are sick. His sickness has arisen from great compassion. He also explains at some length how a so-called sick bodhisattva should control his mind. Here and in later chapters, we find Manjushri, a mythical figure, and Vimalakirti, a historical personality, juxtaposed. Myth and history, face to face. This will be our theme in chapter 5, History versus Myth in Humanity's Quest for Meaning. Chapter 6 of the text deals, as we have seen, with the inconceivable emancipation itself. By his magical power, Vimalakirti transports 3,200,000 thrones from the Buddha land of the Buddha Meru Pradipa Raja, which is innumerable Buddha lands away in the eastern direction. All these thrones, which are apparently miles and miles high, are quite comfortably accommodated in Vimalakirti's house, a magical feat which demonstrates the relativity of space. Space is only a concept, just as time is only a concept. Vimalakirti then describes various other magical feats which the Bodhisattva, who lives in the inconceivable emancipation, is capable of performing. In Chapter 7, Vimalakirti explains, in response to a question from Manjushri, how a Bodhisattva should regard all beings. At this point, a goddess, who lives in Vimalakirti's house, showers the whole assembly with heavenly flowers. The flowers which land on the Bodhisattvas touch them and fall to the ground, but those which land on the Arhants stick to them. Shariputra tries, unsuccessfully, to brush them off. Monks are not supposed to wear flowers. A dialogue ensues between Shariputra and the goddess, in which she demonstrates her deep understanding of the Dharma and explains the wonderful characteristics of Vimalakirti's house. In Chapter 8, Vimalakirti explains how to attain the qualities of a Buddha. For his part, Manjushri then explains what the true family of the Buddha consists in. They both speak in highly paradoxical terms. After this, one of the Bodhisattvas present inquires after Vimalakirti's family. In India, people always want to know all the personal details: who your father is, who your mother is, where they live, whether you are married, how many children you have, and so on and so on. Vimalakirti's reply to this questioning is in the form of a series of beautiful verses, indeed one of the most beautiful passages in the whole work. He says that the Bodhisattva's mother is the perfection of wisdom. The perfection of wisdom gives birth to him, nurtures and nourishes him. His father is skillful means. His wife is delight in the Dharma. His daughters are love and compassion, and his sons are righteousness and truth. As for his home, that is meditation on the meaning of the void. Vimalakirti continues in this way for 40 or 50 verses. Chapter 9 deals with the question of non-duality. Vimalakirti asks all the bodhisattvas present to explain their ideas about non-duality, which in turn they do. They then ask Manjushri what his explanation of non-duality is. They have all spoken well, he says, but their explanations fall short in that they are all dualistic, whereas non-duality cannot be expressed at all. This statement of Manjushri's is very profound, but he does not get the last word, or rather he does. When he has spoken, he asks Vimalakirti for his own explanation of non-duality, whereupon Vimalakirti remains completely silent. This is the famous thunder-like silence of Vimalakirti. When we come to this incident in our sixth chapter, The Way of Non-Duality, however, we will find at least something to say. In chapter 10 of the text, we come relatively down to earth. Shariputra starts worrying about when everybody will be having lunch. After all, monks are not supposed to eat after 12 o'clock. If you have never been a monk, you won't know how important this is. Vimalakirti knows what Shariputra is thinking. He has that magical power too. And it is here that he conjures up a beautiful young bodhisattva, golden in colour, whom he sends off to a Buddha land called Fragrant with All Fragrances to get some food. The bodhisattva returns with a bowl containing fragrant ambrosia, and with him come 90 million other bodhisattvas, who all somehow manage to squeeze into Vimalakirti's house. The ambrosia, strange to say, provides more than enough to feed the whole assembly. In response to a question from Vimalakirti, the bodhisattvas who have just arrived say that the Buddha in their Buddha land does not teach the Dharma by means of sound and language. He teaches it by means of perfumes. This will be the subject of our seventh chapter, The Mystery of Human Communication. In chapter 11 of the text, we return to Amrapali's park, where the Buddha is teaching all those disciples who did not accompany Manjushri on his visit to Vimalakirti. While he is teaching, the whole park suddenly gets larger, and everything in it is tinged with a beautiful golden hue. We get the feeling that something is about to happen, and it does. No sooner has the Buddha told Ananda that Vimalakirti and Manjushri are coming from Vaishali with their retinue than they all arrive. The Buddha proceeds to give a teaching, explaining that different Buddhas teach the Dharma in different ways, yet their enlightenment and their spiritual realizations are all the same. He also speaks at length on the emancipation called the destructible and the indestructible. In chapter 12, after Vimalakirti has explained his perceptions of the Buddha, Sariputra wants to know where Vimalakirti comes from. He is told that the great Bodhisattva comes from Abhirati, Great Delight, the Buddha land of the Buddha Akshobhya in the eastern direction. The next thing is that everyone wants to see this marvellous land, so the Buddha asks Vimalakirti to show it to them, and magically Vimalakirti does so. In chapter 13, Indra, the king of the gods, praises the teaching of the inconceivable emancipation and promises to protect the Dharma. The Buddha then relates how he himself practiced the Dharma in a previous existence, following teachings he received from the Buddha of those days by Sajjaraja. Among these is the teaching of the four reliances, that one should rely on the meaning of the Dharma, not on the literal expression, on wisdom, not on ordinary consciousness, on ultimate teachings, not on provisional teachings, and on principles, not on personalities. We will be going into these four reliances in our eighth chapter, The Criteria for the Spiritual Life. In chapter 14 of the text, the Buddha entrusts this teaching of supreme enlightenment to Maitreya, the future Buddha. Maitreya promises to protect and promote the Dharma, especially the present exposition, which he will ensure is widely taught, copied, talked about, remembered, and understood. All the Bodhisattvas promise likewise, and so do the four great kings, the guardians of the four quarters of the universe. Ananda, who thinks of everything, asks by what name this exposition of the Dharma is to be known. The Buddha tells him that it is to be called the Vimalakirti Nirdesha, and amid general happiness and rejoicing, the text closes.